I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Joukowsky Forum at Brown University and Professor James Dedarian's class on global media. Our guest is one of the clarion prophets of the media transformation. Jay Rosen is professor of journalism at New York University. And at the website known as PressThink, Jay is a blogger on this slow and steady revolution taking place in both the mainstream and the online ways of learning about the world and talking to each other. Jay, I wish you'd go back to a moment that is seared in my memory about 5 years ago when blogging and the web seemed almost brand new. You said to me in a conversation, the terms of authority are changing. Some of the kids here are barely old enough to remember what the old terms of authority were. But would you start there and just tell us, what were the old rules and what in the world are the new rules doing to them?
Hmm. Well, I think we should start by distinguishing between two things that often get confused from one another. The press on the one hand and media on the other. And the press that we have now grew up under one set of media rules. And it found a few years ago that those rules had changed. Or to put it another way, it had grown up on one platform and had to negotiate the very difficult transition to another platform. And that's what my blog is about, is what happens to an institution when it has to, in a sense, rebuild itself on new terms. And what I meant by terms of authority was this. In the old platform, journalism was built on a media system that was one-to-many, one transmitter, many receivers, one way, meaning we told you the news and you listened. It was a broadcasting system in which there were a limited number of channels for reaching the public. And the practices as well as the attitudes and assumptions of news workers or journalists were entirely saturated with those things, one to many, one way, few channels. We have the power. You sit and listen.
These were the days when Walter Cronkite could close a broadcast by saying, that's the way it is. I'm right. Walter Cronkite. You're not. Go back to sleep. We'll tell you if anything happens out there.
So journalism itself was built on this one-to-many platform. It was about, when we had our conversation, to face a huge shift because, and this is where I start the story of transformation, the tools for media production have in fact been distributed to the population at large. Things that used to cost millions of dollars and certainly would cost a new producer thousands of dollars, were now bundled into the internet and available to anybody. On top of that, the internet isn't one way, it's two way. It's not one to many, it's many to many or one to one. And it isn't a few channels, it's millions of channels. And so the way in which journalists could establish their authority in that world was going to be different than the way they established authority in the old world. What A.J. Liebling said was, freedom of the press belongs to those who own one. So what I said was, well, blogging means anyone can own one. And under those conditions, it's not impossible to establish journalistic authority, but you do it in a different way. So that's what I meant.
Come back to the old assumptions. I grew up, and I think you did, James probably too, thinking that the New York Times was God's will and that he edited it. You remind me continually in various ways that the so-called objectivity, that voice of Mother Times, the authority of it, the journalism schools that feed it, are in fact a tradition of about a century old.
Mm-hmm.
Put it in context. Before we go on to the values of the new world.
Okay. What we call today objectivity in journalism is part of a larger development, which was the professionalization of this craft. And that started in the 19, 20s. And objectivity in journalism means many different things. And the problem with talking about it is often that people are actually talking about one of them, but they don't necessarily know it. So it meant a bunch of different things. One of the things it meant was that it was important as the newspaper grew as an economic enterprise to try and address everybody in the community. Up to that point, newspapers had been very much expressions of group identity. They were expressions of party loyalty. They were expressions of class loyalty. There were newspapers for different sort of outlooks on the world. But in the 20th century, the newspaper began to strengthen itself as an economic unit. And as it did, journalists looked for ways that they could address and include everyone in the community. And objectivity became a name for doing that. It's like, let's not piss off anybody and talk to everyone, because then we can make more money. So from the owner's point of view, objectivity was don't exclude anybody. And from the journalist's point of view was don't take strong stands that would exclude anybody. Right? So that's one meaning of it. A second meaning of it was a journalism of fact rather than values, splitting facts and values, and just reporting on facts. And that whole attitude that there's a world of facts out there and we can gather them and sort of put them together and present them to the population without our values entering into it is very connected to the idea of professionalism. And in America, professionals don't claim authority by claiming to be from the right family or from the right clan or having the right religion or being part of the royal family. They don't say any of those things because none of those claims work. In America, you establish authority by saying, I have knowledge, I have facts, I have training, I have certificate. Now, in every other field, it works just fine. You need a PhD to be an historian, right? You have to go to social work school to be a social worker. You have to go to dental school to be a dentist. To be a journalist, well, you can't really force them to be licensed because that's the First Amendment, right? And so instead, the professional attitude had to be internalized, and objectivity is another name for that. Finally, the most useful way of thinking about objectivity is as a method of persuasion. If I want to get you to accept my account, say I was at the Big Street protest and I'm going to tell you what happened. There's different ways I can get you to accept my account. I can say, you're a Baptist, I'm a Baptist, so accept my account. I can say, I'm a Muslim, you're a Muslim, trust me, this is what happened. I can say, I'm from the Boston Brahmins, so trust me. Or I can say, I don't have any particular religion, I don't have any particular view, I'm not telling you have to believe me because I'm from the right family, I was there and I have the facts. So that's what objectivity is. It's a way of persuading us to accept the reporter's account because they were witnesses, because they have the information, because they gathered it without prejudice, and so forth. So all of those things came together, and objectivity is simply a kind of complex of attitudes that works for the publishers, it works for the editors, it works for the reporters, and it enabled professional journalists to gain a kind of cultural authority. And the journalism schools came along and cemented all that by teaching objectivity.
I have a degree from Columbia Journalism School. You better believe me.
In fact, they're still teaching that.
On your website, Jay, which I think a lot of students here have read, you quote Chris Hedges, late of the New York Times, saying, balance and objectivity have become code words to propagate the insidious and cynical moral disengagement that is destroying American journalism. Mm-hmm. This moral disengagement gives equal time, sometimes more than equal time, to those who spread falsehoods and distort information. It tacitly sanctions the dissemination of lies. It absolves us from making moral choice. It obscures and often shuts out the truth. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that? Is that the story of our time?
Yeah. I think he's basically right. What he means is, how do reporters guarantee the authority of the statements in their accounts? Well, sometimes they know it themselves. They can say, I was there and I saw it. But for most things that they're reporting on, it's much more bureaucratic. And what they end up relying on is the authority of officials and experts. And so if you need the official word, if you need the Pentagon to tell you what's going on in Iraq, if you need a White House source, if you can't talk on your own authority because that's not objective enough, then you become open to manipulation. And in fact, this problem first arose in a major way in the 1950s with the rise of McCarthy, where the press was aware that Joseph McCarthy was able, for example, to get charges against somebody into the news, and then 3 weeks later, when it turned out it was just completely fake, that didn't really get into the news in the same way. And journalists were quite aware that they were, in fact, being taken advantage of by McCarthy because they felt they had to quote him as a United States senator, right? And they didn't necessarily quote his victims in the same way, and they were troubled by this. But on the other hand, they didn't exactly know how to get out of it. And one of the solutions they came up with at that time was what they called interpretation. They said, well, we should be able to do a little bit more interpretation, which meant that you could kind of say where the source was coming from and try to indicate that maybe it wasn't completely kosher what he was saying, even though you had to quote him anyway. So it's not a new problem. What Hedges is talking about is not a new problem, but this is the way objectivity solves the problem of who do we trust.
Yeah.
It basically transfers it, right, to officials and experts who are the ones quoted in the news.
It's also become a commercial crisis for the established media today in the Iraq context, I think, in a way that it didn't in the McCarthy era. But let me ask you one more important cut to the present moment question. You got me and many others excited and really believing in the transformation through the blogosphere that, say, on school committee politics or, you know, just even curriculum questions or teachers' salaries, every parent, every child, every teacher, every citizen of Providence, Rhode Island, or Minneapolis could feed in, could cover the school committee meeting, could express themselves, and the blogosphere was sort of peculiarly designed to bring the best opinions and the clearest arguments to the top, that we would cover ourselves that way. Is that, in fact, the way it's working out? And we could take the presidential campaign as an example, or anything else you want.
Right. I don't know if I ever quite said it that way, although certainly the thought occurred to me. But I mean, here's the difference. It's today we've solved the distribution and production problem. Within an hour, you can have a site of your own that enables you to do media production more or less on a par with what a big media company could do. Right? With a few $100 and a little bit of design talent, you can have a site on the web that isn't materially different from MSNBC's site in the sense that it wouldn't turn us off right away, right? So production kind of evened out in that sense. And distribution, of course, is simple. The web does it. So since those were the biggest two barriers in the first place to people getting in on media production, it made sense that once those barriers have fallen, that we would see a flood of new media production. And in fact, we have. However, when you have a flood of new producers and new content, then the editing or filtering function becomes even more important. And so where we are today is we have this explosion of media, and we also have coming right behind it an explosion of new ways to filter content production, right? And they are still important. And so we haven't done away with editors. We haven't done away with choke points. We haven't done away with the power curve, the power laws of the web. We haven't completely evened out the media universe. But we have dropped the barriers to entry. We have created new classes of producers. We have broken the monopoly of the one-to-many media system. We've introduced all kinds of new forms and new openings. And so the situation is a lot more interesting, a lot more fluid, a lot more complex, a lot more open, a lot more democratic than it was. But the way that we handle these changes is we just go to extremes. We say, oh, now the media system is completely open, and then somebody can come along and sort of debunk what was a naive idea in the first place. And this is sort of how people kind of get their bearings in this world, is we rush to proclaim a revolution, then the skeptics come in and say, not so fast, and then over time you see that the picture is changing, but not quite as radically as we thought. So that's where we are now. We have a much different media system, and the automatic authority of the broadcast media and the one-to-many elites has, in fact, fallen away. So to me, that's a great democratic opening.
I want to come back to the 2008 campaign as a kind of test of these realities. But first, James Derderian, it's your turn.
Well, I want to come back to the question of objectivity, but in the context of today being the fifth anniversary of the Iraq invasion. And I'm genuinely split about this issue of whether old media was better at it or worse at it than the blogosphere. Mm. You know, on the one hand, you have, I agree with you, and I'll quote Walter Benjamin. I'm allowed three Walter Benjamin quotes per Chris Lydon session. so I'm going to use up one of my quota. And in this case, he called this false realism, the sort of Ronkian view of history, telling it like it is, as it really was the great narcotic of the 20th century. Because he saw how easily, you know, not only could you manipulate the truth because of what the time of the interwar period, the new media of radio, the new media of cinema, the great optical fairylands of the picture palaces.
Right. The same things that led Lippmann to write his book.
Yes. Yeah. So on the one hand, I agree with you and with Walter Benjamin. But on the other hand, we were basically fed a crock about the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. We were told, of course, that there was a link between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. Mm-hmm. You know, William Sapphire said this was indisputable. Cohen, an esteemed journalist from the Washington Post, you know, talked as well about weapons of mass destruction, saying that only a Frenchman would believe that he didn't have weapons of mass destruction.
Right.
And we could go on and on about the smoking gun becoming the mushroom cloud. So at one hand, I'm thinking, okay, if we can't be absolutely sure because of the difficulties of finding objectivity in the press, how does that play into the ability of political elites to manipulate the truth? That's the one question. Then the sort of second follow-on to that is the blogosphere acting as sort of a check and balance? Does it offer up perhaps a better test because there's so many different news sources, so many opinions out there? Or does it water down the whole sort of criteria of objectivity? Mm. Meaning, if right now, 2008, we had not yet gone to war with Iraq, would, given the vibrancy, the robustness of the blogosphere, would those lies be sustained given assault by various bloggers against them?
Right. I think the same thing could happen again, for sure. The reason it happened is you have a situation very much like political campaigns where the information is closely held by a small number of people. Lots of situations aren't like that. Let's take the mortgage meltdown. The information isn't held by a small number of people. Lots of people know about it. And so we can have interpretive wars over what it means, but lots of people know about it. But with the invasion and the case for the invasion of Iraq, that wasn't the case. And the reason why the press was fooled so badly was that in its mind, the people who knew were the people in the Bush administration who were making the case. And they disregarded in many ways. They downgraded in other ways those voices who were skeptical, partly because of what I said earlier. The way you authenticate your account is with official authority. And if official authority is telling you one thing in kind of a wave, then the fact that there are other voices saying something else is really kind of small to people in the press. And if we have a situation like that again, where the information about what the administration plans to do and when, as well as why, what their reasons are, what the intelligence says, all of, if you have a situation where all that is very closely held, then the press is extremely open to manipulation. And it's still the case, because there's nothing about blogging that changes that. What is different, however, is that the whole process of checking up on the media, reacting to what it is doing, matching up what it said 2 years ago to what's happening now, going back and looking at what pundits said to see if it had any basis in fact, sort of taking a kind of retribution on those who were way wrong or highly credulous, the criticism and accounting that comes after the fact, there's no comparison between then and now. We have way more tools for that. We have way more people who are engaged in that act of criticism. And it has had a major effect on the press, because they know now when they get something wrong that they're going to hear about it, not just from their sources, but from lots of other people. They know that when they do something truly outrageous that upsets millions or thousands of people, they're going to have to kind of account for that. And the environment that they work in now is completely different. One more thing is, and I've written extensively about this, and I'm writing about it right now because I'm engaged in a forum at Talking Points Memo about the five-year anniversary of the Iraq War. In fact, if I wasn't doing this, I'd be working on that. But in this particular case of the Bush administration going to war, another factor entered into it, which is I don't think anybody in the press was able to imagine the scale and sort of radicalism of the Bush project in general, not just in Iraq, but in everything. I don't think they were capable in a way of seeing how things like the expansion of executive power, the use of terror, of torture, the war in Iraq, the war on terror, how all these things connected. They're almost prevented by their own professional codes from seeing that full picture. So that it's even more difficult than just getting the right sources and a small group of people have the information. In this case, I think they were defeated by their own imaginations, which were incapable of grasping what was actually happening, and still are to some degree. And what happens is that when you have narrated a whole series of events over years under a set of assumptions that were faulty, when you realize your assumptions were faulty, you don't go back and re-narrate. You can't. You've already done that storytelling. It's already in the books, as it were. And this is part of the reason why journalists are so defensive about the war, is that they got the whole thing wrong from the beginning. For example, none of the reporters reporting on the war, none of them, even considered for a moment that the United States had invaded a country like Iraq without a plan. It was inconceivable to them. It was beyond their imaginations that the United States could invade a country without having a plan for what to do once you were there. But later events have shown that's exactly what happened. They still can't wrap their minds around that. And so you can't go back and change it. And so in a lot of ways, in this particular case of Bush and the war, the problems are in a way intellectual.
I have to do a brief Watson public service announcement that we held a conference on dissimulation, simulations by the media, between 9/11 and the Iraq invasion, where we brought dissident voices, including some former weapons inspectors like Scott Ritter and others, and some reporters who were trying to get their stories out, but they couldn't, or they just didn't get the audience. So in some ways, it was a failure. There were some voices, but it was a failure to disseminate or find a level playing field for those voices. They were drowned out.
Yeah.
And Knight Ritter did a pretty good critical job as well.
They did. They were better. And part of the reason they were better, which is now the McClatchy watches in Bureau because they got absorbed by another company, but part of the reason the Knight Ritter Bureau did a better job is that nobody in the White House or high up in the Pentagon wanted to talk to them. They weren't important enough. So if you have a position and standing in Washington, you talk to the reporters from the New York Times.
Judith Miller.
You talk to Judith Miller. You talk to the Washington Post. You talk to the Wall Street Journal. You don't talk to Knight Ritter. And so Knight Ritter had to figure out what was going on in the White House by going to players outside the White House, by going to the agencies, by going to mid-level bureaucrats. Of course, lots of people know what's going on there, but they just don't have the same title. They don't have the same august authority, right? So Knight Ritter's advantage was that nobody would talk to them at the White House.
What if the story was too big, Jay, for the New York Times even to begin describing it?
It was.
I'm thinking of a chance gathering with Russell Baker and Tony Lewis, both later the New York Times, columnists, reporters, magnificent, I mean, giants of the old world of New York Times journalism. And Russ Baker said, do you ever get the feeling that your country has been hijacked? This is an insight about a story that I suppose began with the 2000 election in Florida and included all those things you were talking about. It was common sense. It was a general intuition. And yet I can't imagine the New York Times beginning to follow that lead. By the way, readers, your country has been hijacked.
Right. This is something I've thought a lot about. I think you're on the right track for sure. If you want to get away with something, if you want to elude the press as a check on power, your best bet is to do something really big and really radical, because it's way easier for them to miss something huge than, let's say, a little scandal like Elliot Spitzer's scandal. You know, or
man and
you know,
prostitute.
Or standard corruption. Something really big, like what I call the retreat from empiricism. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is so large and so strange, so hard to wrap your mind around, that chances are you'll get away scot-free. So
cut
the bigger the crime, the less likely you are to be noticed by the press.
Cut back to the present. I wanted to ask you about blogs that have real traction and that are beginning to become something like online clearinghouses for information with something like the old journalistic authority. And you mentioned Talking Points Memo,
right,
which is a place to start. But I wish you'd just run through the blogs that, you know, 5-10 years down the road are beginning to fulfill the promise that you saw for them.
Well, first of all, let's look at what a blog is. The first blog that I ever studied, because a student of mine told me about Instapundit.com. And when I looked at it, I didn't understand what Instapundit was at first. That site, which is simply a bunch of links from smaller sites that are buzzing about all kinds of things, but in the same sort of general universe of sensibility, which is sort of techno-libertarian center-right politics, which is Glenn Reynolds' politics. He's the author of Instapundit. That tells you what some of the potential is, because the universe of people who make Instapundit go are not just the several hundred thousand readers, but 1,000 or so authors.
Hmm.
So right there you have an improvement over the newsroom, because, in fact, the 1,000 or so blogs that Glenn will link to are a lot more diverse than any newsroom, even though they're all, you know, sort of centered on the same political sensibility. other blogs that have become large like that are, in a sense, you could compare them to previous media properties. That is, Reynolds has the same traffic as LATimes.com. But unlike LATimes.com, there's thousands of authors who are creating that that site, and it's a lot more diverse. It's a lot more flexible, right? And it's capable of kind of renewing itself in a much more dynamic way than an old newsroom culture. So so I consider that site still to be. And it had a big galvanizing effect on creating more blogs like it. Right? Now, if you take a different kind of site, would be Daily Coast, which is on the left, has similar number of readers, actually more. But unlike Instapundit.com, Daily Coast is an online community. It's an online community. You join the community. There's nothing to join at Instapundit. You can't even be a member. There's nothing to sign in. There's no login. You just go there and you consume it. And interestingly, the right-wing sites tend to be less community-oriented and much more, here's the news. Right? Stop and get your fill and leave when you want to. Daily Coast is different. The Daily Coast idea is everybody gets a blog. Everybody who joins the community gets their own diary. Everybody's a reader and a writer. This goes back to what Dewey said. You're a reader and a writer. And the front page is filtered the best stuff from all the writers. So that community is capable of reacting quickly to events, right? Of creating a kind of critical mass of opinion, of not only buzzing about the news and making dissident voices heard, but also of, to some degree, organizing itself for political and informational ends. And it's by far the most vibrant and successful online community that I know of. And it is capable of certain critical acts. So, for example, in 2004, 6 weeks before the election, when Sinclair Broadcasting, you remember this, decided to air an anti-Kerry documentary with 3 weeks to go before the vote, an unheard-of act in American broadcasting, because the owners and operators of television stations in the past have always been very hesitant about getting involved in an election because they understood on some level that if they become too political, ultimately Congress could take their license away because they're not supposed to do that. So along comes Sinclair Broadcasting, which without anybody even realizing it, had become the largest owner of television stations in the country by buying up all these small stations. And it was a very political company that was run by basically right-wing hacks. And they decided to air this anti-Kerry documentary 3 weeks before the election on all of their stations at once, which I think they had like 84 stations. This is totally unheard of. The Daily Coast community said, this is outrageous. And they organized themselves to basically compile within a few days a dossier on Sinclair Broadcasting, which they put online to find out who this company is, how they're organized, who runs them, how they've benefited from government decisions in the past, and why they might be so anti-Kerry. And they weren't really anti-Kerry. They were just pro-Republican. So that, the presence of a community that's kind of alert and waiting for events is a very successful example of blogging at work.
It raises money and it endorses, I mean, it fields candidates, really.
It raises money for kind of obscure candidates that might get overlooked by the party. Now, part of the significance of that site is that it's capable of challenging not only the media elites, but the political elites, that is, the people who've always run the Democratic Party. And there's a huge tension between what is now called the net roots, that's the name for the people who collect at sites like that, and the people who've always run elections and run the political party. And that tension is just as significant as the one between, let's say, Daily Coast and Instant Pundit.
I want to get your take on two others in particular, Huffington Post and TPM.
Okay, well, Huffington Post arose because of a peculiar fact about the news media's adaptation to the web. When the major news sites, when the major news organizations started their online operations, which was around 1996, they decided that the best thing to do was repurpose their content. What I mean was they took the news and features that they produced for the daily newspaper and they took them and put them online, right? Repurposed their content, which makes sense because after all, you've already paid all the costs. You can put it on another platform. You can get more readers that way. You might be able to get a little advertising money, right? And in creating these original sites which repurposed their content, they had a number of other ideas about the web, and one of them was that you don't send people away from your domain. So when the WashingtonPost.com first came online, it never linked out to some other site because it wanted to give you the illusion that we're the Washington Post, we have everything. We're the Chicago Tribune, we have everything. We are the Chicago Tribune. We have local news, international news, business news, automotive news, sports news, science news. We have everything because we're the Chicago Tribune. So why would you go anywhere else? And as a result, they missed one of the most powerful things about the web, which is called aggregation. Aggregation is, let's take the best stories about the mortgage lending crisis and put them all in one place, wherever they appear. Right? So the principle of aggregation is link to the best stuff on the web. And the major news organizations were too proud to do that. They were too arrogant to do that. They were too clueless to do that. And this is what gave rise to Drudge. What is Drudge? Who is Drudge? Drudge is just somebody who figured out that if he found it before anyone else on the web and put it on his site, people would come to his site. That's all Drudge is. Drudge is the first person to find stuff when it appears online. That meets his test of news. And Drudge built a huge audience by doing that.
He broke the Monica story, and it's also worth noting he broke the story of Prince Harry of England fighting in Afghanistan just a couple of weeks ago. I mean, he forced it to the top of everybody's agenda.
Yeah, when you say he broke it, he doesn't really break them. What he does is he finds it and he puts it on his site before anyone else. Okay, so Drudge happens to be sort of like Reynolds. He's kind of a techno-libertarian right-winger. So the Huffington Post original idea was we need aggregation from the left. And the success of the site is built largely on that. The other thing the Huffington Post is, besides aggregation of news constantly, 24 hours a day, is she realized that lots of people have something to say about what just happened. And if you give them the right to say what they want to say, and you ask them to comment, some of that will be very effective. So they borrowed what Daily Coast does, and she has thousands of bloggers now who write for the Huffington Post, and they filter the best stuff to the front page. I was just on the front page of the Huffington Post yesterday with my comment on Obama's speech and CNN's handling of Obama's speech. And so she's aggregating news. She's aggregating users. And because the news is there and the users are there, lots of people want to write for her. So that's how the Huffington Post works. And if the major news sites hadn't been so arrogant to say, we're the Chicago Tribune, we have everything, there never would have been a Drudge or a Huffington Post. So now the Huffington Post is evolving. It keeps growing. It's like amazingly successful. Now it's evolving. If you go to the Huffington Post, you see on the top it says the internet newspaper, which is basically
interesting claim.
The internet newspaper, as opposed to a newspaper that we put on the internet, right? This is the internet newspaper, and that's how they've succeeded.
So what's TPM Cafe?
Okay, Talking Points Memo and TPM Media is, in my mind, really the first web-born media company, first news company born on the web. And it was created by this guy, Josh Marshall, who's a very traditional journalist in his 30s. Not my generation, not your generation, just one generation younger than me.
Brown-trained historian.
Brown-trained, that's right. He has a PhD in history from Brown. He wanted to be a political journalist. He wanted to be a Washington reporter, like thousands of people before him. And he went through a route that many others have gone through before, where instead of going to journalism school and instead of getting a job in a small paper in Kansas and hoping to jump to Cleveland and then jumping to Washington, which is the other route, you basically use your connections in the Ivy League to get yourself an internship at the New Republic or the Washington Monthly political magazines and jump from there to a staff job and from there to a writing position. So somebody like Dana Milbank from the Washington Post, he came up through that route. It's not available to people like me who went to state universities in Buffalo. It's only available to people like you. But he did that. And he didn't want to wait 20 years until somebody would give him a column because he thought he was smart enough now to have a column. And when the internet came along, he basically wanted to start his own site because he was tired of working for other people. So what Talking Points Memo grew into was his adaptation of a political news and opinion magazine to the web. And what makes it distinct is that he is a traditional journalist interested in reporting, investigative reporting, who nonetheless has none of the stuffiness and hesitation about the web that older media organizations do. So, for example, he learned that his readers, who are very interested in politics, know a tremendous amount that he doesn't know. And when a story that he's following gets into an area that he doesn't understand that well, like, well, what is the U.S. attorney in Phoenix up to, and why would she have been fired? You need somebody in Phoenix who's really following the law to inform you. And so what he learned is that his readers have tremendous amounts of knowledge, and that if you simply ask them to help you, they'll send you lots of stuff. And even though they'll send you lots of stuff that you don't use and you can't use and that's not even that good, they'll also send you a lot of stuff that's good, that you can use. And so over time, simply by adapting what he was doing, trial and error, learning through story by story, he's created this news organization that is constantly pumping information in from its readers, filtering it, matching it up to what's going on in the news, employing reporters, and pumping it back out. And he combines original reporting. He has a staff of people working for him who are like doing traditional kind of reporting, digging into documents, calling people on the phone, finding stuff out, with aggregation, what I just explained, and opinion, meaning when Roberto Gonzalez does something truly outrageous at the Justice Department, at the front page of Talking Points Memo, you see Josh Marshall sounding off on it, just like a blogger, right? So it's traditional opinion blogging. Community forum, that part of the site is called TPM Cafe. That borrows from Daily Coast. You can go there and get your own site, get your own blog. The best of the reader as writers is filtered to the front page. The final element is like open source journalism, which is lots of people contributing lots of information to our investigation. So to wrap this up, when during the U.S. Attorney's scandal, the Justice Department released 3,000 pages of emails, and the young aides at the House Judiciary Committee who read Talking Points Memo put all of the emails online as PDFs. Two reporters who work for Josh Marshall said, how are we going to go through these 3,000 emails? There's probably one thing in there that we need. Right? There's probably one email that tells us the story, and they hide it by giving us 3,000 irrelevant ones, right? That's how you do it in Washington. You comply with the request for information by giving them 50 times more information than they wanted so they can't find what they're looking for, right? How are we going to do this? We have only a weekend. And they realized they didn't have to do it themselves. The information was online. They could ask their readers to do it, and that's exactly what they did. They said, look, go to this site that the House Judiciary Committee set up. The emails are on these PDFs. Download a section of them and look through them. And if you see anything interesting, just put it in the comment thread at the blog. That's exactly what they did. Now, why did that system work? Well, it worked because of the web, because readers are writers, because it's a two-way and not a one-way, because it's not one-to-many, but many-to-many. It worked for that reason. But it also worked because all of those readers had been following Josh Marshall's blog. They'd been following the story. They knew enough about it. They knew the background well enough so that if something jumped out at them, they'd see it. If something was important, they would know it. And so they actually used the readers as filters for their investigation. And Talking Points Memo was the news site that basically uncovered the scandal involved in the U.S. attorneys being fired that eventually led to Gonzalez's resignation. So in traditional journalism, if you stay on a story long enough and you do great work and you force a public official to resign, that's like, that's the ultimate. That's Pulitzer Prize winning territory. That's what you live for. And here you have this blog that did exactly that.
And he got a Polk for that.
And
right?
He got a George K. Polk award
right.
for that.
That sounds in some ways to be the equivalent of parallel computing for the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Do you know how you link up all the local computers? And
yes, it's very related to parallel computing.
And it sounds brilliant. It's like extra Washington, extra political intelligence through this new technique of networking.
Yes, yes.
But it would be based, and I think you've made this point, on, again, trust or integrity, not neutrality. You go out after a particular goal. You're not pretending to be neutral in this search.
Right. Yeah, this is one of the distinctive things about Marshall, is that he's, on the one hand, he's a traditional journalist in the sense that he's interested in what you can prove. It's as simple as that. How do we know what happened? Well, in order to really know, we got to go interview people. We have to go find documents. We have to dig through the records. We have to look at the emails. And so he's very traditional in that sense. But he doesn't pretend to have no politics himself. He has very clear convictions about right and wrong, about which party is just and fair, and he doesn't make any attempt to hide his politics. And this is what's so distinctive and so interesting about his blog. So this is part of the gift of blogging, because he doesn't have to try and create a newspaper that addresses every single person in the Los Angeles basin. He's not trying to do that. He can instead aggregate 500,000 people around the country and the world who are interested in his kind of politics. And he has about 500,000 monthly readers. That's a lot. 500,000, that's a lot.
I'm going to raise an issue that usually causes Chris to reach for his Glock, and that's ethics. But I'm wondering if there isn't a prior ethos that the right to free speech, the right to speak also implies an obligation to listen mm-hmm. attentively, listen with care, mm-hmm. And that seems to be missing sometimes from blog sites. Am I wrong about that or not?
No. But you're overlooking something. What draws people to the web is initially is something deeper than that even, which is simply freedom. Freedom, that is, the right to speak their minds. And before it's sort of settled, before it's cultivated, before it's civilized, it is initially a space of freedom. And so it's true that there's a lot, sometimes there's a lot more speaking than there is listening online. So the internet is not a civilized place, you know? It's not a nice place. It doesn't obey your law of civilized discourse. It doesn't care what you think about the right way to exchange ideas. It says, screw you. And myself, as a Democrat, small-D Democrat, I have a lot of tolerance for that. I have a lot of sympathy for that. But if you want things to be nice, you know, don't go online.
So, James, as an ethical watchdog, who do you want to bite out there in the blogosphere? Who do you suspect?
Yeah, who's violating your sense of right and wrong? Tell us.
Well, it's really shameful to say, but I have to quote Benjamin one more time. That I think
maybe that's good.
I think history.
That's twice.
I know. I got one more left in my pocket. History decays, he says, not into stories but into images. So I spent a lot of time on YouTube. And there, you know, my bete noire are bets, are animals. Why do we have so many stupid pet stories? Mm. You know, what is it about the web that seems to be so, you know, probably about three quarters is porn, maybe one eighth is pet stories, and then the other one eighth is something intelligent life, you know?
Is this bad taste or bad morals?
Both. Bad taste comes at the top. I think bad aesthetics is worse than bad ethics.
There's no solution for this, but it's true. However, if you looked at sites by traffic, or if you looked at self-created blogs by links, you would find that with pets and with kids and with food and with baseball blogs and all these other things, politics is one of the most important things. So that's kind of cool if you care about democracy. And I'm not so concerned about all the pets. It's kind of a tradition in political blogging. This bizarre tradition arose spontaneously of Friday cat blogging. So lots of political bloggers, for no particular reason at all, on a Friday, they just put up a picture of their cat.
Yeah.
Between, you know,
now we know
U.S. attorney scandal in the Iraq war.
It's not me. But I have to say, before I get flamed and get tons of email about my statement about pets, I have to tell you, I have a dog, and I named it after Walter Benjamin. His name is His name is Wally. So please, nobody flame me or Chris's site because of any of this commentary. It will offend my dog.
Pets, wait a minute. Let's stick for 1 second on pets. Remember when all this tainted pet food came into from China? Came in, okay. So you have bad pet food is being imported from China, and it's actually killing some dogs that ate it, right? Well, there's all these pet blogs out there, just like Jim said. And most of the time, you know, they're at the level of, here's a picture of my dog. Oh, isn't he cute? You know, and if you can imagine comment threads about cute pets. Right? That's pretty much what's going on there. Right? So a whole sphere, pet blogging. But this story of tainted pet food suddenly spreads across the pet blogs. And when they go to their newspaper to find out about it, there's almost nothing there. You know, you get a little 3-inch wire story. It's like nothing compared to what they want to know about this. How did this happen? Who's responsible for that? Wait a minute. Is this supposed to be somebody supposed to check the safety of our pet food? Who's falling down on the job? Nobody wanted to tell these pet bloggers. So you know what happened? They did it themselves. They did it themselves. And certain pet blogs became headquarters for the pet food scandal.
Yeah.
They began to collate and collect information about it. And they got so on top of this story that Congress itself went to the pet blogs. And influenced by what they found there, held hearings on this. And it was the pet blogs that got to the bottom of what happened with this tainted food. Okay, this is to me is a very interesting story.
Here's
why? Not because, and the lesson of it is not that everybody wants to be a journalist now, or everybody can be a journalist. That's not true. But almost everyone might someday be in a position where they have to be a journalist because the media won't tell them. And that's the significance of the internet. Not that everybody suddenly now is a news provider, but that anyone could be. Anyone could be.
This is the moment, I think, to go to the people, hear from the students. Please join the conversation at one of the mics here in front.
Hi, I'm Emma, and I want to return to YouTube and perhaps stray from pets and porn. I'm wondering, admittedly, I may be behind the times, but you know, I read the newspaper in high school, and now I read it online. But what has changed in my behavior is my use of YouTube. Mm. I become particularly keenly aware of media coverage, especially around elections, for example. You know, Michelle Obama is not patriotic. Was that taken out of context? I don't know. I'll go onto YouTube and I'll watch the entire speech.
Right.
And, you know, I think back to Howard Dean in the 2000 election, and I had friends who were on that campaign, and they said he actually wasn't screaming. You know, if you had been there, if someone had posted a YouTube video with a different kind of microphone, everything may, you know, it changes media coverage so mm-hmm. much. And it's, I also don't feel the need to credential someone who is taking a video because mm-hmm. it's a real witness, as you were saying, report.
Right.
I don't really care about what their motives are because it's right up there. So I was just wondering what you think about, you know, can YouTube maybe be institutionalized or does it depend on someone reading something in the news and then going
right.
to the source?
Well, YouTube is an example of what I said at the beginning, which is the tools of media production have been distributed. That already happened. They left the building. And YouTube is a way that we can now access the products of that revolution. And so it's not only, what makes it successful is not just that it's a place where you can put your videos online. That's half of what it is. The other half is, and this is why Google bought it, it's a place where you can find videos connected to what you're interested in, right? So it's filtering. Production plus filtering equals community. That's how it works. And there's no doubt that this has opened up television. It's changed it into something that not everyone will do, but anyone can do. And this is a huge fact that's changing the politics of media, changes the political economy of media. Just think about how important it could be in a situation where there are street crimes and the regime is denying it. Right? We didn't beat up any of those monks. Oh, yeah? Here's the video. Right? It totally changes the control of information. And that has super serious consequences in closed societies and mildly serious consequences in open societies.
Last question is about the New York Times, with which I'm slightly obsessed. Worked there, been reading it all my life. I read it now as much as anything for clues about the transformation, including the news this week that the hedge fund investors have sort of forced their way onto the Times board to get them to cut costs, which may mean reporters, but also even to sell their new signature building off Times Square, not to mention their piece of the Boston Red Sox. The New York Times keeps laying off people. It keeps changing, not in entirely bad ways, but I just wonder, what's happening there? You follow the anthropology, the sociology, the psychology, the power of the New York Times better than anybody mm-hmm. I know, Jay. What does the Times tell you about what's going on?
Well, the Times is a unique property. It's a unique institution. I think it's an extremely valuable institution. And it would be a tragedy if it just fell apart or became like everything else. So that's number one. The second thing is that the Times, like the Washington Post and other elite news products, discovered the internet and discovered that they have way more readers online. The Washington Post has 10 times as many readers online as it had when it circulated as a printed newspaper. And the Times, it's similar kind of ratio.
10 times more readers online than in the
yes,
paper?
Yes.
I thought it was like about a million each.
No way. No.
Sorry.
Circulation is in that range. But if you look at regular use online, the Washington Post site has about 10 times that many. So they gained huge numbers of readers online, but they're caught in an economic squeeze. And the economic squeeze is that the readers are moving online, but advertising is not, or it is, but at a much slower rate. And the reason for that is even more fundamental. The newspaper of old was kind of a compendium of unlike things that were blended together because in that day, in that age, it was the most economical way of doing it. So we put the sports news together with the auto news and the classified ads and the international news because economies of scale were such that that was the smartest.
And the bridge column and the –
Yeah, and the bridge, right. And now – if you're interested in bridge, there's a zillion bridge sites that are much better than the old bridge column that you can go to. And if you're interested in a car, well, you go to autotrader.com because that's just for cars. And if you want a roommate, it's much better to go to Craigslist than it is to go to the classified ads of the newspaper. And so this is called unbundling. The unbundling of the newspaper means that some of the things that were all brought together in this sort of awkward fashion under the old platform are now being distributed around to sites that do them much better. And so it turns out that what the New York Times really has after all that is not its printing presses. They aren't that valuable. They're just going to run out. It's not the advertising because that's leaving. It's going to the web. It's not the classifieds, which basically are over now. Newspaper classifieds have died. It's instead this reputation, the reputation for trust and reliability. So they know that much. They know that they are successful online. They don't know how to recapture the advertising revenue that they've lost, and they're caught in one other dilemma that fascinates me, and it's this. They understand that they need to become more transparent online. By transparent, I mean telling people where you're coming from, owning up to mistakes, correcting yourself when you're wrong, engaging in a back and forth, explaining how you make decisions, all of these things that, in fact, create trust online. However, the New York Times as an institution has always worked in a completely different way. It's been what I call a cathedral of news, mm-hmm. where you don't tell people how you make decisions. You don't explain where you're coming from. You don't tell them what you're going to do. You just put it on the front page. If you want to know what we're about, watch the paper. This is what Bill Keller always says. He loves to tell you, watch the paper. See? So they built up their authority basically by not explaining themselves. But they're now caught up in a publishing environment where they have to explain themselves. And they end up veering from one to the other. They can't really commit to transparency on the one hand, but they don't want to relinquish their authority either. And they can't decide if they want to be the priests of news who have a certain mystique about them or whether they want to be the most potent and transparent news organization on the web. And the only person who could resolve, in my view, that sort of fundamental strategic choice, cathedral or transparency, is the publisher. Arthur Sulzberger Jr.
And the tragic thing for the New York Times is that he's just not up to it. He's just not smart enough. He doesn't have enough depth. He doesn't have enough vision to make that choice.
Jay, that's brilliant. I just want to gild the lily, though, with one thought. It seems to me you could argue, well, that the most important thing about the New York Times, the great value, is not even its reputation. It's its readership. Richard Rovere wrote a piece in The New Yorker in the 50s, I think, in which he said basically the American establishment, what is it? It's the people who read The New York Times and vice versa. If you want to join the club, become a regular reader of The New York Times. I keep waiting for The New York Times to liberate its readers to report the news.
Right.
Stop telling us what happened. Ask us what happened. The web is a perfect device, actually, for filtering the nuts from – not only the nuts from the real ones, but – good commentary from bad. Good reports from Kazakhstan from bad.
Right.
If they would only turn that telescope around and listen to their readers, it seems to me we could be approaching a new day.
Okay. Can I respond to this?
Please.
Okay. It's a very important point. Dan Gilmore was the technology reporter for the San Jose Mercury News back in the 1990s. Traditional journalist. But he just happened to be reporting on Silicon Valley because he worked for the San Jose Mercury News. So he was the first newspaper reporter to ever get a blog because he knew what blogging was. And a few months after doing his blog, he realized – and he could have realized this a lot earlier, but it took blogging to teach him that my readers know more than I do. My readers know more than I do. And you can imagine why a technology reporter in Silicon Valley would say that, because it's true. And this was always true. This was always true of any beat reporter, that readers in the aggregate knew more than the reporter. But what's different today is that because of the web and because of the falling costs for people to share information and collaborate, that knowledge that readers have more of can now actually flow toward the journalist. So the number one asset of the New York Times is, you're right, is not just their trust and reputation. It's actually the knowledge and sophistication of the people who read the New York Times. And if the newspaper could begin to reverse that flow, right, so that they're taking in as well as broadcasting out, they would become, I believe, a news powerhouse. But they don't want to do that. They hesitate. They fumble the ball. They hem and they haw because it doesn't fit with their notions of authority, to go back to the beginning. It undermines their ideas about the cathedral of news. It undermines, in their view, their authority. If they start asking people, what do you know? That's not the business they want to be in. That's not the business they thought they were going to be in when they joined up with the New York Times. The glory of the New York Times is not, hey, tell us what you know. It's, we're going to tell you what we know, right? And you're going to listen to it. And so it's this nostalgia, in a way, for the world. But what's for the world of one-to-many communication. What's fascinating about it for me as an observer is that the people who work at the New York Times, no matter what anyone tells you, are very intelligent people. They have their eyes open. They read, they watch, they observe. And they know this about transparency. They've had consultants come in and tell them, you know, your number one asset is really your readers. They know what open source journalism is. They even read my blog occasionally. And they know what I stand for in this. And they know what I would urge them to do, what you would urge them to do. But they can't bite the bullet, primarily because, in my view, it doesn't fit with their self-image. Mm-hmm. Isn't that funny?
Well, it's very funny, and it's very threatening.
Tragic.
I want them to wake up before it's too late, you know? After they've sold the building and laid off half the reporting staff, it could be too late.
In a situation like that, where your people have to make this big shift, that they weren't prepared for and they didn't sign up for. The only way that can happen in a big institution is when the person at the top knows it has to happen. Mm. It's the person at the top makes it happen. And the problem with the New York Times is it's like Attali said, sometimes you get a bad king, right? Mm. Sometimes you get a bad king, meaning you get a king who has to be king because they're next in line, but they're not up to the job. And Arthur Sulzberger Jr. is not up to the job, but he doesn't know that.
James Dudan.
Well, I know. Pithy conclusions. I was just going to say we're running out of time, but I think I've got one arrow left in my quiver. I'm allowed
Please.
One more quiver.
One more Benjamin.
Yeah.
You're the king.
I think what's been demonstrated today that when you live in times of terror, this is a direct Benjamin quote, when everything is a conspiracy, everyone must play the detective. And in this case, the investigative journalist online. So thank you very much for proving that once again to be not only our prescription, but now showing us, you know, how to do it. Thank you very much, Jay.
Thank you. Thank you. Fun to be here.